You're listening to the Leaping Cholla podcast, recorded in the Wrong Mountain Yurt in the Sonoran Desert.
I am falling away from this world. I am falling away from this world. You are calling me back to you.
All right, so this is episode one of Leaping Cholla podcast. I'm here and you're here, right?
I am here as well, yes.
Great. And so we talked quite a bit about what we should do on the first episode. And because we kind of see it as a place where people can, you know, a lot of people will start there, and that'll be their introduction to what's going on. And of course, some people might go back and reference it for context. Do you remember what we decided?
No, I don't remember. No?
I guess I kind of do. I mean, I think we want to talk about a little bit about who we are and how we came to decide to do a podcast and what we think is going to be discussed in the podcast. Does that sound...
Yeah. But do we want to read some Heidegger first or no?
That's a fair question. I would say no. What would you say?
Okay. Sure.
I guess I kind of feel like we should kind of introduce the whole thing and then we'll read some Heidegger and then talk about the Heidegger and then just because I feel like at the beginning of it should be those sort of core preliminary points. Is that okay?
Sure.
Though you do bring up the topic of Heidegger, and so let's maybe say right out of the bat, right out of the gate, that at least in the first iteration of this podcast, we're going to be reading a book out loud, word for word, and discussing what's in it as a kind of filter or touch launching off point for all the other things we're going to talk about. I'd imagine that eventually we'll finish the book and move on to some other book or some other thing. But for the beginning, first phase of this podcast, that's what we're going to do. And that book is Contributions to Philosophy of the Event by Martin Heidegger.
Do
you want to go first?
No.
No, I know you don't.
Should we could talk about how we found the book.
I like that. So, so why this book? Let's start there and then we'll work backwards to who we are, how we got here and what our goals are and what we plan to discuss. I have read a lot of Heidegger, in my life. Much of it in German, along with a lot of other philosophers. It's kind of one of my main reading genres. And a few years ago, I guess, when we were living in New York City, where we don't live anymore, I spent some time listening to the book while riding on my bike, which is where I did a lot of my listening, aka reading. And I listened to it, and, you know, I was aware that it was an amazing book. I will say that, you know, I listened to it through this, you know, it's not an audible book. There's no nice narration of it. I used a program where you can kind of take, you know, text to speech and get a robot lady to read a book. So I wasn't quite sure how much of the nuance I'd gotten. But I thought it was amazing. And I think I even said to you after I'd finished it that I'd read kind of or listened to the greatest book of philosophy ever.
I think you did.
Yeah. And then about a year ago, we had our first baby. And you were nursing the baby in bed. We were co-sleeping in the early days of the baby's life. And you kind of woke and went back to sleep as the baby fed, and I slept through the night. And then when it was time to get up with the baby, I would get up with the baby in the morning, and then you would continue your sleep to catch up. So I remember that I was just kind of like sleeping, and I looked over occasionally at you working through the night, nursing our son, and you were reading a book on your phone as you were nursing. And at one point, I guess I asked you what you were reading, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you said that you had gotten Contributions to Philosophy of the Event onto your Kindle app, and you were reading Contributions of the Event. Mm-hmm. And I was like, wow, that's a pretty intense midnight nursing reading for a new mother.
Midnight, 3 a.m.
Yeah, exactly. Midnight, 1 a.m., 2 a.m., 3 a.m. Definitely not light reading. And I was not only impressed, I was also curious. And I think somehow, how did we start reading it together?
Well, I think that I asked you some questions about it because I was reading it, but I wasn't necessarily understanding it, or at least not all of it for sure. And so I think I was started asking you about it, and then I liked what you had to say, and I liked what that opened up about the text. And then I think we got, I'm not quite sure when though, we got into just sitting down and reading it.
Yeah, I'm not either. I mean, I think, I feel like it was 6-8 months ago, maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah, basically we'd put our son to bed and we would sit down and read the book out loud and talk about it, and not just talk about the book, not just talk about the ideas in the book, and not just try to figure out what the book was saying, but it caused us to go off on a lot of different tangents. It seemed to be talking about a ton of things that we were interested in. Mm-hmm. And so we went through some of the book, and we decided that maybe what we were talking about was something that might be exciting to share in a podcast. And so that's how we ended up here. Mm-hmm. Does that sound right?
Yeah.
So, should I go on?
Yeah,
yes, I should. I guess I'm going to try to talk as briefly as possible, right? And I guess I'm going to stick to that pattern of like, who am I? How did I end up here? And what do I see this podcast containing by way of topics? Does that sound good?
Yeah, great.
So, I am primarily a playwright. That's what I'm known for, I guess, among the four people that know me. And I've been a playwright for a long time, 30 some years. I've written a lot of plays. And I did most of that writing in New York City. I lived in New York City from 1990 to 2022. And between 1990 and 2012, I was involved with lots of people who worked with me to produce my plays, helped me. They were directors and actors and dramaturgs and producers and patrons and designers and audience members, the whole thing. That went up and down until 2012, so 1990 to 2012, 22 years. And then in 2012, things had gotten kind of so poor, I would say. Raising money had proven to be harder. A lot of people I knew had moved away. We'd all gotten a little older. People were having families. My executive director, who had been a driving force in my plays, moved on. I was having a hard time finding actors who would work for not much money. I didn't have a space anymore. I was doing plays in our living room. I was working on a play as I'd always done, and the play was falling apart. Nobody was memorizing their lines. it was taking over my life. I was going insane, and we were like three nights from opening, and one of my actors didn't show up for the dress rehearsal, and so I kind of made a very rare decision in 22 years, something I'd never done, and I canceled the whole production. And I told everyone that it was kind of over and they needed to go home. And I shut the door and I shut the gate on our yard. And in my mind, I quit the theater. I quit writing. And I sank into kind of into a negative space. And I just kind of stopped writing, which I hadn't done in 25 years. And I sat down in front of a microphone every morning when I would normally be writing, and I started dictating my meditations and my dreams and my thoughts. For 3 years I did that. And I ended up with a giant, once it was transcribed, book of notes and thoughts that I would say expressed what I was observing and feeling at the time. Then, kind of feeling like my playwriting life was over, I was suddenly, through kind of a Facebook connection, asked to join a residency at the New Museum in New York City, which is really probably the most important contemporary art museum in the country. And this was like a big opportunity. And it was at the New Museum. It was with a group of 15 other theater artists who are pretty big. One of them has won a Pulitzer Prize. One of them is probably going to be running Lincoln Center soon. One is probably going to be running the Public soon. These are actors and playwrights that work on large stages. And so I joined this residency. It was called XID Rep. And I'd like to read the little blurb about it. It says, this is from the New Museum's website. It says, working within a pop-up repertory theater model, XID Rep is a research-driven enterprise designed to examine the shifting ethical boundaries surrounding intercultural cross-play on contemporary American stages. The project brings together a group of directors and playwrights recognized for their diverse approaches to staging across various identifications of class, race, gender, sexuality, ethnicity, and ability, among others. These artists will cast a resident company of actors with whom they will collaborate to develop material that further highlights a spectrum of approaches to the topic. Their rehearsal-based research will unfold in a studio environment that will be open to the public at set times and will culminate in a performance presentation of their findings. Operating from various positions of agency and privilege, the members of XID Rep will collectively examine the constructs of staging, intercultural cross-identifications, while directing our attention to the social conditions from which these constructs emerge and persist, perniciously or otherwise. That's quite a lot, huh?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I'm going to quickly list the artists who took part. Becca Blackwell, Liliana Blaine Cruz, Dre Campbell, Yuri Jong Choi, Jackie Sibley's Drury, Kareem Fahmy, Mykia Jennings, MJ Kaufman, JJ Lind, Greg Mazgala, Aya Ogawa, Nigel Smith, Alexandra Tatarsky, Sori Sukada, and Amelia Workman. And the whole thing was run by Travis Chamberlain, who was the associate curator of performance and manager of public programs at the New Museum. So long story short, I went into this residency. It was supposed to be 4 months, culminating a performance. Am I going on too long?
No.
And I always try to keep this short. And essentially the four playwrights, we four playwrights would each bring in some pages, and the four directors with the eight actors would kind of workshop the pages and talk about what was on the pages. And I would say that it pretty early started to be clear to me that this was 2016, before a lot of this stuff was really out there in the open, that this was definitely going to be about class, race, gender, sexuality, ethnicity, and ability. And that those topics were going to be what it was about, and that that the tensions in that were going to be central to what people talked about and did. I came in and I basically, everybody kind of had an identity, you know, and I came in and I was very overt about saying, I think my identity is the failed playwright. That's what I wanted to pursue. That's what I wanted to write about, what it was like to be a failed playwright. And, it was clear early on that everyone kind of that fell kind of flat in everyone's perception, and that I was in fact kind of the able-bodied white male in the group, and things were said and approaches were taken that implied that I was representative of, the problem, and that's a quote, the problem in the world. And so but that was all kind of cliche and rote, and I'd heard some of it before. But then in the middle of the residency, an event took place in the world, and it was essentially that there's a play called The Mountaintop by Katori Hall, who's a black female playwright, very highly produced Broadway playwright. And this play, The Mountaintop, received a production at a theater in Cleveland, run by a guy named Michael Oatman, who's a black male playwright and director. And Oatman decided to do The Mountaintop, Katori Hall's play, which he got the rights to do in a small theater, I believe at Kent State University, a little theater, like 65 seat, you know, thing. And he cast a black guy as Martin Luther King. He lost that actor. He cast another one. He lost that actor. He cast another one. He lost that actor. All those actors disappeared for personal reasons, I think, you know, money, and I think one guy's dad died. And then Oatman decided that, you know, he was getting so close to opening night, he cast a friend of his, an actor he knew, who was a white man. And the play went up, and with a white man playing Martin Luther King. And Katori Hall got wind of this, and I kind of threw, I guess I'd say, a bit of a, well, she protested. She protested. She wrote a letter that was published, I think, in American Theater, or The Root, I think, somewhere. And she basically really condemned this production, really condemned the casting of Martin Luther King as a white man, condemned Michael Oatman's decision.
And he ended up losing his job, didn't he?
Yeah.
And how many theater artists signed that?
Well,
or is that later?
So, you know, I met Oatman afterward, and he said that he pretty much stopped getting work. He pretty much lost his position at the theater, I believe. That's a vague memory, but he was maligned, mocked, and ridiculed, and humiliated in a variety of places. To begin with, Katori Hall had her publisher put out a new edition of the play, saying that if you wanted the rights to do the play, and only a black man could play Martin Luther King. And then 2,000 theater artists. Or was it 14? Some 2,000 theater artists signed a letter that appeared in American Theater Magazine supporting Katori Hall's decision to condemn this production, and talked a lot of stuff about representation and the erasure of the black body, and how, you know, it was important that this man be presented as by someone of the same race, and blah, blah, blah. So this happened in the world, and I thought, oh, this is an interesting IXID topic that's just happened. So I think I'm going to bring this event into the residency, and I'm going to show up, and I did, with a speech that I wrote called Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Returns from Heaven to discuss the topic of who is allowed to play him. And so it was written in like a Kingian style, speech style. And I submitted the play to the residency, and this was what I wanted to be done in my performance. You know, as it says on the website, the performance presentation was to be in January of 2016. And shortly thereafter, I received an email saying I needed to come to the theater for a meeting. So I showed up, and everyone was there except for Jackie Sibley's Drury, who had apparently quit the residency and called a meeting with all the artists, all 15 of them, except for me. And they had decided, and they decided to cancel the residency. They canceled everything. They canceled the performances. They shut the whole thing down. And they told me that, and I said, why? And they said, we're not allowed to tell you. Our hands are tied. And then that was it. And everybody kind of stood up, and I protested a little bit. I said, I've worked for 500 hours writing these things, and I feel like I should get a performance as promised. And I don't see it as fair that you called a meeting that I wasn't invited to, blah, blah, blah. But they didn't care. So then it was over. And so I went home, and everything that I had been sitting and thinking about from 2012 to this time all of a sudden made complete sense. And it was just that identity had stolen the theater. Identitarianism had taken over the play space that had existed. And I don't need to say that that's obviously the case if anyone knows of the theater. And I became very disillusioned, and I decided to leave New York City, which we did. So we don't live in New York City anymore. We live in a yurt in the Sonoran Desert. And the speakings and the writings that I did during that time around this concept of identity and theater form what are going to be 5 plays of mine. I call them my religion. And the plays all together are called The Feeling and the 5 Play Cycle. And I plan on using this podcast as a way to think about what I wrote down in those years and what my religion is about and what my plays are going to be about and what I think about various things as they come up through the topics raised in contributions to philosophy of the event and as they just come up in our conversations. So we live here now out in the desert, and we have a little baby. And I think lastly, I want to say that I think we are really interested in asking ourselves how to raise this child in today's world in a way that makes him and our other kids, we're actually pregnant, we have another baby on the way, in a way that provides our children with freedom and life and love and happiness and imagination and the good life. So that's it for me.
Well, so
why don't you talk? And I sense if you're, I'm warning you, if you're at all reticent, I'm going to ask you questions because I know what questions to ask you that will hopefully elicit.
Can you remind me the 3 you started with, the 3 questions?
Who are you? How'd you get here? And what do you see being discussed? In this podcast, why? What are the topics you feel like you'll bring to this podcast?
Okay.
And I will remind you, you don't. You only need to reveal as much as you want to. No one is forcing you to do anything.
Well, I am an artist. I moved to New York City in 2008 or 9, I can't remember. And at the time I was doing modern dance. And through being despondent about the status of modern dance and performers, like not owning their own image and having to try to fund that experience, I ended up with a very, voracious online art practice, or very odd, very unusual, ended up basically in some odd combination of performance art, social practice art, visual art, performance art, all done online. That was pretty cool. I really enjoyed that. And yeah, and I went to art school in 2013. Ended up in 2015, I kind of launched into another project that I call my Celebrity as Art Practice Project, in which the goal was to create a celebrity as art so I could appropriate my own image as celebrity in my artwork. That ended up being very successful in some ways and not successful in other ways. And we do have a 5.5 million Instagram, which is pretty successful in that way. But, you know, we'll table for another time the nature of celebrity in mainstream and in the art stream. What happened? I've enjoyed making art. I still make art. Right now I'm really into AI art. That's my favorite medium. I think of what I dealt with before was Photoshop as sort of the first half of my art career. And now what I'm moving into is AI as the program that I work in. And I'm very excited by what it offers. I had some run-ins in New York City with people not liking, well, lots of run-ins with actually everywhere people not liking my art. It's seen as very provocative and some people don't like that. I had a cancellation experience in a Facebook group, which due to a photo of me with a bongo, is that what it's called? Bongo? Mm-hmm. Is what started it, because that was inappropriate. And so I just...
What was that Facebook group?
It was Starwave.
And what was the mission statement of that Facebook group? The constitution of it?
I think it was like a feminist art group.
Right. You were physically threatened by some members of that, I believe.
Yeah, I think she was a member. That's right, yes. And so that led into a lot of various hate that I would get for my projects, and I was physically threatened by someone who said, if you see me in a dark alley, walk the other way.
You had another cancellation experience at a pretty big open studio in New York City as well, by the way.
Yes, that's right. That was like 2012. Specifically,
but you had, yeah.
Yeah, that was interesting because I was accepted into the open studio, and then when I gave them my artwork, the director said that I was a commercial entity and not an artist, and that my work was an ad and not art. So, you know, I think for me, I tend to be kind of hurt by these things first, but then I'm like, oh, wow, that's really fascinating. How are you telling me what I am and where are you drawing these lines and stuff? So, yeah.
Had many cancellation experiences.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
Just being on social media.
Oh, being on social media. Well, and then there's also, like, I've had, like, someone who was a club that was commissioning a work,
yes,
say that they were commissioning it, and they said that the board decided not to continue the commission, and they cited the reason of the Me Too movement, which is kind of ironic because I am a woman, and I thought the Me Too movement was supposed to like support women. And
yeah, you had a show in Seattle.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean the list goes on. I've had a lot of.
We went out there and we worked very hard on it, and then it was canceled.
Yeah,
a lot of cancellation. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, a lot of cancellations. What's the sort of next question?
Yeah, so who you are, how you got here. Yeah, and you live with me
here. Yes.
In this yurt.
We've lived together a while. Yeah.
We met in 2009, so you'd actually moved to New York in 2008.
Oh, yeah, 2008, thanks, yeah.
Yeah, so because we met the year after you got there. We have mated, and we have a child and another one on the way.
Well, you didn't even bring up the whole, which maybe you will later, but like your whole cancer experience, which is pretty...
Yeah, sure. Time. Yeah. Yeah. I got cancer in 2019, lymphoma, a very deadly form of lymphoma called double hit.
And triple hit.
Yeah. They were never quite sure if it was double or triple, but yeah.
Two and a half hit.
I was hit hard many times. And I went through chemo. I almost died. But I have been clean of cancer for, I think it's 4 years now, over 4 years. So I feel like it's over. My doctor pretty much intimated that with the aggressive form of cancer I had, that it usually comes back pretty quick, and it has not come back. So yes, that happened. That I would say stalled our retreat from New York City.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was being treated there, and anyhow.
Yeah,
I would have left earlier, but yeah, that's right. And you, what did you miss? You must have missed lots of things. No, so who you are, how you got here, and what you see being the topics.
Yeah, well, and so for me, a month into COVID, I started to develop a lot of anxiety, and so anxiety and reading Heidegger. I guess we started in 2023 reading it. It became a very actually interesting way for me to look at the anxiety and to understand it and to think about it. So that's a big theme for me, is dealing with anxiety.
Yeah, I think that's right. During our conversations about the book, as we... started going through it, we found a lot that there seemed to be relevant to talking about what anxiety is. You've done a lot of reading of what are pretty much prototypical books about anxiety, mm-hmm. like current medical and therapeutic approaches to anxiety. I don't know if anybody's ever used contributions to philosophy in the vent to discuss anxiety, but we started seeing lots of ways to do that. And it also a lot of the stuff that I was thinking about in terms of identity...
Yeah.
And that I was infusing into my play also fed into that, and there became different elements of that as well, and how they bled into anxiety. And anxiety, you know, I think also not only, you know, you suffering anxiety and wanting to get it out of you, but also we live in the age of anxiety and the general anxiety, the anxiety in the media, the anxiety in our friends, the anxiety in our families, the anxiety on the internet, anxiety in the mind virus and all that stuff. So yeah. Yeah. Anxiety. I think another topic is just, our families, I guess. We're raising new babies, and we both come from families, and we're trying to think of ways that our new family could be an improvement on the past. I guess to be straightforward about it, both our fathers are professors. Um, Our mothers, I don't know, I guess they're not the same thing. Our mothers are children of the 60s, I would say, as are our fathers. Our mothers are both very intellectual, active women. My mother is a yoga teacher, and I guess your mother is technically retired.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say that both of us were raised in, I guess I'm going to say, very liberal-minded households. Both our parental units are very active, ideologically driven, and they identify very strongly as American liberals. And so I think a lot of the things that we're going to be talking about are going to be us trying to think through that and think about what that's handed us and what is good and what is maybe not good, and or just trying to understand it. I would say liberalism is kind of for us, you know, you always meet kids and they're raised by religious parents. That's what I would put it. And I would say both of us feel we were raised by religious parents and their religion was liberalism. And so I think we're just kind of trying to figure it out just in the way that any kid tries to understand the religion of their parents. Mm-hmm. And of course, your parents have an extra religion,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yes.
So your parents actually do have an actual religion because they are Jewish.
Yeah.
And my parents don't really have an actual religion, but your parents have that on top of their religion of liberalism.
Yeah.
And so we're going to talk a lot about that, I suppose. Anxiety, identitarianism, growing up liberal, liberalism, theater.
The art, visual art, we'll talk a lot about. We've gone to thousands, probably, of shows together. And we're very, and all, like, the art fairs and stuff, so we do have a lot of thoughts.
Yeah, we've obviously gone to a lot of arts. You've been on the board of major museums. We've shown your art in major international art fairs.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, we've been in the art world a lot. And so a lot of what we're going to talk about is the art world. Yeah, and I guess that's it. But I think for now, most importantly, what we're going to do is we're going to read a book. And we're reading the book because we both love the book. And the book has opened our minds to so many things and seems to be so running so parallel to so many thoughts we're having. And seems to be hinting at from long ago, you know, it was written way back when, middle of the 20th century, but it seems to be hinting at and striving for so many things that we are as well. And it seems to shine so much light on so many of the basic structures of how we think and what we hope for and what we're seeing and what we hope to see. That the book has just been an absolute revelation for us. And, right?
Yeah.
And so we want to read the book, and I think we should turn to the book.
Okay,
now.
I have one last thing to say.
Yeah, please.
Because you didn't mention again in the end there, I think that the religion, the five-book religion that you're working on is a huge theme as well, that we're going to talk about more as we go. And I think you asked me, we were trying to figure out the other day what, I don't like these sorts of questions, like who are you and what, your story, and I never know what to say for them, but it did make me realize that I think before my anxiety started, I had this, we were working on a project where I was a religious figure and I was making images of that. We had a bit of a narrative Instagram going about that. And I was thinking about that. I was like, wow, how could I be a spiritual leader? Is that some, you know, what would that be? How would that be? And I just remember very distinctly that I mean, I think that when I'm assessing a new persona or person to be for my online life, it's generally always a pretty positive thing where I'm like, oh, wow, this is really cool. I'm going to jump in this or try that or something. And it was probably too early, but I think I was trying to just share with my parents what was going on because they were pretty upset about COVID. And I still just remember very distinctly that my mom said to me, you're going to be the head of a religion with an incredulous attitude. And shortly after that was when my anxiety started. And so I also have, I think, sort of a hope for myself that I could get to the point where I would be like, yes, I am. I can be a religious leader if that's what I am and if that's what I want to be.
Amen. Great.
So that's all I want to say.
Yeah, great. Okay, well, tell you what, I'll read the title and the little formatter, and then you can start.
Okay.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
So the book is called Contributions to Philosophy of the Event by Martin Heidegger. And before the book starts, he writes, what was held back in long hesitation is herewith made fast in an indicative way as the straight edge of a configuration.
One prospect. The official title, Contributions to Philosophy and the Essential Rubric of the Event. The official title must by necessity now sound dull, ordinary, and empty, and will make it seem that at issue here are, quote, scholarly, quote, contributions to the, quote, advancement of philosophy. Philosophy can be officially announced no other way, since all essential titles have become impossible on account of the exhaustion of every basic word and the destruction of the genuine relation to the words. The official title, however, is also in accord with the, quote, matter at issue, end quote, to the extent that, in the age of transition from metaphysics to thinking of being, in its historicality, no more can be ventured than an attempt at a thinking which would arise out of a more originary basic position within the question of the truth of being. Yet even the successful attempt must, in conformity with the basic event of that which is to be thought inventively, keep its distance from every false claim to be a, quote, work in the previous style. Future thinking is a course of thought on which the hitherto altogether concealed realm of the essential occurrence of being is traversed, and so is first cleared and attained in its most proper character as an event.
Why don't you read the last paragraph?
Okay.
Then we'll just cover this whole section.
The issue is no longer to be, quote, about something, to present something objective, but to be appropriated over to the appropriating event. That is equivalent to an essential transformation of the human being from, quote, rational animal, end quote, to Dasein. The fitting rubric is therefore of the event. That is not to be understood in the sense of a report on it, about it. Instead, it means that a belonging to being and to the word, quote, of being, a belonging in thinking and saying is something appropriated by the event. And I should add how I read quotes is if it's a one word, a quote in one word, I just say quote. And if there's a quote that has multiple words, then I do say the end quote.
Cool. Do you have anything to say about it or should I?
I mean, honestly, what really jumped out to me this time was like, I didn't realize, like, he, in how he uses the word appropriating. And, like, I'm always talking about, like, appropriating images and art. Mm-hmm. I never really thought of it, like, as any relationship. I wonder if there is.
Yeah, well, that's an interesting point, because appropriation in this book is spoken of as not only a positive, to be appropriated, mm-hmm. And to appropriate, so passively and actively appropriation, is a very positive thing, not only positive, but essential to the rubric of metaphysical and philosophical transformation that he's advocating for. And of course, appropriation is now a dirty word.
I mean, sometimes.
Sometimes, I guess, yes, yes. Well, you know.
I mean, yeah.
It not a dirty word?
Yeah. Well, I like to think when I use it, when I say I'm trying to appropriate my image, but, you know, no one else uses it that way, really. Appropriation, at least the way I understand it, kind of really was started with Richard Prince, and he was, I guess, appropriating in that art context means taking an image that one did not create and using it in an artwork, and thereby creating a derivative work that one claims to be their own. Mm-hmm. So, like, appropriating, and it's most commonly done with, well, I guess, perhaps, like, soup cans, for example, a la Warhol. Or if we're thinking Richard Prince, like, images of models, or images of celebrities tend to be the most common things. Mm-hmm. And that often exists in, like, collage works or more straight up mm-hmm. replication works.
But you sought to generate a celebrity project where you could appropriate your own image, because appropriation is something that you did not want to happen to you.
Yeah.
You saw it as stealing or demeaning or just inappropriate. And so you use the word appropriation. You're going to appropriate your own image, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think it's actually, it's okay if they're, like, credited and get, like, a percentage or something.
Right.
The model gets, like, something or approves. I mean, I don't know.
Right, that's the point.
The
appropriation always walks the line between being theft.
Yeah.
And being
honor.
Yeah, exactly. And, of course, the internet has made appropriation a widespread activity. As Ryder Ripps said, appropriation is what the internet is built on.
Yeah. Well, that and porn.
Yes, but almost all porn is appropriated, I mean, in a sense. Appropriated by websites that post it that don't own it. Mm. Stolen. But of course, we have cultural appropriation, identity appropriation,
right, yes.
All that stuff. So
right,
that's
right,
a different
right.
thing. But let's get into, should we get into what we were just
yeah,
read?
Yeah, sorry. Where?
Should I go ahead? Or?
Yeah, do it.
Okay, yeah. I mean, we see in the first paragraph.
Wait, sorry. Let me try to wrap that up. So, but what I think is kind of cool is, like, so when I say appropriating my own image, I'm really just saying it's like I have a specific relationship to the image because it is me, and thinking about it in terms of, like, we'll discuss with him about the appropriation of oneself into the event, into oneself. I'm not sure how to describe it. You'll describe it better, but that's actually kind of a lovely, that's kind of in a way what maybe I'm trying to do with my art.
Yeah.
I never thought of that until now.
Yeah.
Anyways. So now go back, please.
I mean, he starts by saying philosophy can be officially announced no other way than by, you know, basically having a title. That seems scholarly, and seems to be contributing to the advancement of philosophy, all of which he has in quotes, which makes one seem as if he's trying to avoid that way of thinking. He says, all essential titles have become impossible on account of the exhaustion of every basic word and the destruction of the genuine relation to words. So right away we see that I think Heidegger sees the exhaustion of basic words and the destruction of our genuine relation to words as a problem, and hopes to remedy those problems, to or at least work within the realization of those facts. So our relationship with words and the exhaustion of basic words is being put forth by Heidegger as a fact, and we'll hear more about how that's happened. And then I think, you know, so we have right away, we have this, the entry of this word bang, B-E-Y-N-G, and we're going to pronounce it bang. And the reason we're going to do that is that, as I said, when I listened to this book, I listened to it through a text to speech program where the computer figured out how to pronounce everything. And this robot woman that read the book to me, said for B-E-Y-N-G, bang. But if you listen to any Heideggerian scholar on YouTube or on their personal website, they tend to just pronounce it being, B-E-Y-N-G, being. B-E-Y-N-G is an Englishification of S-E-Y-N, which is the German. Being in German, B-E-I-N-G, is spelled S-E-I-N, sign. And so S-E-Y-N is just an older form. It's almost like an old German form of sign. And so English translators have taken the I in being, B-E-I-N-G, and turned it into a Y and used the word B-E-Y-N-G. So bang is how we're going to say that. And the distinction between bang and being is going to be very much what this book is about. And
wait, how do people just say it being though on their YouTube channel?
Know.
Does it make any sense?
They just do. And it's pretty disorienting.
Okay.
I mean,
because they're very important. It's an
incredibly important distinction. And I have to say, whenever I've sort of listened to someone talking about the book and they say B-E-Y-N-G being, I right away think this person has missed the central point of the book. I don't know how I can continue to listen to them. That's just the way it is. That's the way the world is. I mean, I kind of wonder, I mean, if I hadn't been listening to the book through this robot woman, if I would have pronounced it different, I probably would have said being with a Y. But bang, I think, is a very happy accident.
Yeah.
So he says the official title is, however, in accord with the matter at issue, quote unquote, of this book, what this book is about, to the extent that in the age of transition from metaphysics to the thinking of bang in its historicality, no more can be ventured than an attempt at a thinking which would arise out of a more originary basic position within the question of the truth of bang. So we are going to be transitioning from metaphysics to the thinking of bang in its historicality. That's very important to think and to remember. That's the transition we're going to be making in this book. Metaphysics to the thinking of bang and its historicality. Mm. And we're going to be doing this through an attempt at a thinking, at a way of thinking, comes out of a more originary basic position within the question of the truth of bang. So we're going to try to develop an original basic position within the question of the truth of bang. So we're asking the question of the truth of bang. And again, we need to figure out what bang is, but we're asking the question of its truth and taking a position in it. And that thinking is going to help us transition from metaphysics to the thinking of bang and its historicality. Yet even the successful attempt must, in conformity with the basic event of that which is to be thought inventively, keep its distance from every false claim to be a work in the previous style. So all this thinking we're going to be doing about the historicality of bang, the truth of bang, and this transition to bang from metaphysics, we need to be sure that this is not a work in the previous style. It is not a work of philosophy in the way that all works of philosophy have been presented. Future thinking, rather than these past works, is a course of thought a course. And course, you know, gives a sense of movement, of path, on which the hitherto altogether concealed realm of the essential occurrence of bang is traversed, and so is first cleared and attained in its most proper character as an event. So bang is going to become clear to us as having its most proper character as an event. And the issue is not to be about anything. The issue is no longer to be about something, to present something objective. That is gone, says Heidegger. Rather, the issue is to be appropriated over to the appropriating event. So the whole point is to be appropriated to an appropriating event, an event that appropriates you. And that appropriation is equivalent to an essential transformation of the human being. An essential transformation will happen via that appropriation from rational animal, which is the way that all philosophy has thought of human beings prior to Heidegger, to Dasein, which is Heidegger's word for human being.
Nice.
The fitting rubric of this title, therefore, is of the event. That is not to be understood in the sense of a report on the event, but rather it means that a belonging to bang and to the word of bang, a belonging in thinking and saying, is something appropriated by the event. That belonging is appropriated by the event. So those are some core terms in the book: bang, event, truth, historicality, metaphysics, transformation, appropriation. That's a nice little early summary of kind of where the book is going to head.
Can I read one quick thing from the introduction I was just noticing?
Please do.
I was noticing this before we started, but there's a nice introduction to this translation. And they say that that at issue in the contributions are indeed private ponderings not composed for publication. So basically, it's like his notebook. There are sections that aren't completed. There are lists. And it's, I don't know, I just think that's an interesting thing to keep in mind with it as well. But yeah, the translator also says that they believe it's his second greatest book next to Being in Time. So, even though it's
his second greatest book, yeah. Interesting.
Do you think it's his first greatest?
It's very hard to say. I mean, I find it more earth-shattering than Being in Time. But Being in Time was and is very earth-shattering, and is much earlier than this book. It's the book that introduced Heidegger's thinking. It might represent a greater break in the history of metaphysics. But to me, the discoveries in this book are more far-reaching and more profound, and I think it's a greater book.
They almost seem like the application of what was discovered in Being in Time.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right.
Yeah. I mean, I didn't read Being in Time. But
yeah, Being in Time is like the early mapping, and this is the full realization of
what that is.
The place that was mapped. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think in the distinction between being, B-E-I-N-G, and bang, B-E-Y-N-G, that he's gonna start to discuss in depth, I find a symmetry with my distinction between what I am delineating in my plays as a distinction between identity and, in a sense, feeling, or identity and theater. I think they're very, it's a similar dichotomy, and the realms that each one describes are similar. And I think that I just remember so much talking about how that we did a lot of talking about how that the relevance of all that to anxiety, not just that you were experiencing, but that is going on in the world, and how being and identity have a, I would say, a causative role in anxiety. But I think being and identity have further metaphors. And I think that with being and an identity being related as philosophical structures and their effects on us, you know, I think that metaphysics is another word in there. I think that the first beginning, as Heidegger describes it, which is the establishment of the philosophical codes and rules by the Greeks, the first beginning. I think machination, which is a word he's going to use. I think all those words lie in one column of how thinking and philosophy and sociology and psychology and history and politics of all kind of centered themselves in that column, and that the transformation that's going on that we're trying to talk about to theater and feeling and freedom and anxiety-free and a new and the other beginning, as Heidegger describes it, and bang, B-E-Y-N-G, and the event. The transformation to that second column, that's the transformation we're talking about. And so when we use the word religion on this in this context, you know, I think that really what we're talking about is an attempt to express, and to a certain extent, entablature or codify the methods of that transformation. And that's a long project, but I feel a little bit like that's what we're trying to do. Because that transformation is not only something that we're trying to institute, you know, at a quote-unquote religious level. I realized I needed to do a quote-unquote there because there were two words, religious level. but that transformation is so that's not only, well, that's that, for me, that transformation is professional. It has to do with my role in the theater and where my plays land and what my plays are trying to achieve, at least the next five plays that I'm writing. I think it's professional for you. I think that with your experience with cancellation and your experience with ostracization, I think you think that maybe that transformation or publicizing that transformation might start to open doors and realms for you in which you could experience a little more freedom and acceptance. I think that transformation holds out the hope of your living free of anxiety and not feeling anxiety. And that transformation exists for us personally. So to transform as children of parents, to grow up and to go free and to improve on our rearing, and the hope lies in how we raise our own children. And ultimately then the hope for the transformation lies for the whole world. For everyone our goal, I think, is to talk about this transformation and hypothesize and fantasize and describe how this transformation might be something that is wonderful. Right?
Yeah, it's well said. Yeah.
And So that's, I think, what we're hoping to do by reading Heidegger. And the book has given us so many just like immediate personal aha eureka moments, you know, and has just, I mean, there's just, it's countless times that it's like we read something and we decipher it and we're like, geez, that just like really resonates through everything and just describes at a really basic structural level so many things going on. And I think we hope to just like share that, right? And to have those epiphanies in front of other people and open the book up. And by opening the book up, open the world up and open our thinking up and try to make our thinking freer and more open and more truthful and more genuine and more pleasurable. Right?
Yeah, well said.
Would you say that the, I guess, yeah. Yeah, I guess that's it.
Yeah, I think that's a great spot to close.
So that's our podcast. This is our first episode, and that's kind of what you can expect. And we have lots more coming. So have a wonderful night.
Good night.
From the yurt, good evening.
Thanks for joining us for the Leaping Choya podcast. For more information, visit leapingchoya.com and be sure and follow us on socials. Until next time.